Happy Shabbat, everyone. Welcome to the Yada Yah presentation, the continuing presentation of the Mizmor 119. For all of those listening, I'm sure you realize that is the song to the Torah, the most important psalm of all, the psalm that devotes 22 refrains of 8 verses apiece to each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, demonstrating the very concept that Yoshe was making when he said that not a single yod, the first letter in Yahweh's name, the smallest of the Hebrew letters, or tittle, the strokes that comprise the other Hebrew letters, would ever be annulled so long as the heavens and earth exist. Hello, James. Hello, Larry. How are you guys?
Doing good.
I'm okay.
Good. I'd like to jump right in. I was struggling with the statements that are brought to us by the letter Rosh. Rosh is depicted in Hebrew by the drawing of a individual's head. So it just describes, you know, when you think of Rosh, you ought to think of using your eyes to see, to be observant, using your ears to listen, and of course the subject is the Torah, so, and the author is Yahweh, so we're using our eyes and ears to read and to listen to Yahweh's words, and then our head so that we can process what we have observed and heard, and be able to think about it and come to a reasonable conclusion based upon what we've seen and heard. And so under this letter, the statements were challenging to me. Now, I want to tell you what my mistake was, because I may not have caught all of them this afternoon in preparation for this show, and I find great pleasure in announcing that I have made a mistake. I find that being able to say quite honestly that I was wrong in my attempt to translate the Yahweh's word or my conclusions regarding it is the ideal position to be in, because what it says is, well, then if you found that something that you said or wrote was incorrect, but you have corrected it, it says that, well, then you're still focused on his testimony, you're still learning, and that you've got the right attitude. And with Yahweh's word, the right attitude is always have the humility to recognize that he's a lot smarter than we are and that we're flawed at this point. And when you can admit that you make mistakes, then you're still useful. You know, the moment you say, but I can't lie, you know, but I can't do anything that's wrong, like Paul did, then you become absolutely useless. So my mistakes here were primarily in the imperative. The imperative is an expression of volition in the second person. And, you know, I've always shared as part of these programs how important the moods are in Hebrew. And the moods, pagogic is a mood, cohortative is a mood, and the imperative is a mood. But they're first, second, and third person expressions of volition. Now, that's difficult to convey in English. And the reason it's difficult is, as we will see, as we get into these passages, since the imperative is a second person expression of volition, but there was no pronoun you, which is, you know, the second person is you, associated with the verb, which in this case is ra'ah, to see, then how do you convey second person volition in English without adding the pronoun you? You can't do it. So it caused me to express volition, but within the pronouns that were already there, as opposed to recognizing that, you know, English isn't written like Hebrew, and if we're going to convey the information that's provided by the moods and the stems and the conjugations in Hebrew, then we're going to have to add words. That's just all there is to it. So I'm going to add words that are required to express the intent of the imperative being an expression of volition. Now, give you an example. Mizmor Song, Psalm 119, 153. I had originally written it because I understand that the imperative is an expression of volition. Volition just means choice. Volition can communicate two things. And, I know, and I apologize up front if I'm being too focused on grammar here, and you just kind of want to get the meaning and don't want the grammar lesson, but this is what I enjoy.
You can't
this
get
is
one
what,
without the other.
I don't think so either, and I don't think you're listening to this program that you've devoted time out of your evening at the beginning of the Shabbat if you don't love this stuff. So I'm going to assume that everybody listening loves this stuff, the details of it, as much as I do. And if I'm wrong, send me an email, and we'll use the time differently. But unless I hear differently, I'm going to assume that this stuff makes all of you as excited as it does me. So I originally had this, recognizing that the imperative expresses volition, and there was no you there. I just said, but there was an expression of first person that I said, I want you to. And then it would go on to respond show a willingness to answer my call. But it's really quite different than that. Because it's the imperative written here is a second person volition, you, it really is, you want to see me respond. You want to see my diligence, my willingness to answer the call and actively engage. I mean, that's profoundly different than I want to see. Dode is expressing his understanding of Yahweh's will. You know, the exemplar prayer that is attributed to Yahusha is, your will be done. Well, what he's doing here is expressing Yahweh's will. I think while it has value to us to know what Dode wants, if we're studying the Torah, and if the purpose of the psalm is to explain to us how to understand the Torah, isn't it vastly more important to know Yahweh's will than it is Dode's? And since Dode is speaking to Yahweh through this psalm, he used the imperative to express Yahweh's will. And
so we want to see Yahweh's perspective as opposed to Dode's. Sure.
Right.
That's what the same thing that happens with
me.
Time. Yeah.
Exactly. I missed it when I translated this. And I'm going to tell you, since I was just doing this recently, I'm sure that I have not properly worked this into the verses that we're going to be considering, so we're going to have to work through this together. But that said, the thing that's really important in understanding the Torah is coming to know the author. And if I were to itemize the important things in the Torah, I'd say the single most important aspect of the Torah is coming to know the author. Coming to know who Yahweh is.
That's the reason.
Coming to know his name, coming to know what he has done, coming to know what he is offering, coming to know what he wants, coming to know what he expects, coming to know what he has said, but coming to know his persona. I don't think there's anything in the Torah that's more important than coming to know Yahweh. And knowing what a person wants, what they've chosen, is hugely important. That's what this is doing. It's expressing Dode's understanding of what Yahweh has chosen, what he wants. You know, second to that, the Torah teaches us what Yahweh is offering. The Torah proves to us that Yahweh is God. The Torah provides a path for us to walk in that will fulfill Yahweh's promises regarding the benefits of the covenant. I mean, there's a lot to learn from the Torah, but fellas, can you think of anything that's more important in the Torah than coming to know, A, who God is, what he's like, and what he wants?
That's the main reason for the Torah. That's why God gave it to us. That's why we should study it. If that wasn't, you know, there, it'd be, I almost say, almost useless.
Yeah. I think so. In fact, I think the whole presentation of the covenant is specifically tailored to present Yahweh as he is, which tells us what he's like and what he wants. The covenant is a family. It's based on Bereth, which is based on Be'eth. Be'eth is family and home. And so when you have a family and you are the head of the family as the as our Heavenly Father and spiritual mother, it tells us a great deal because we know what fathers want. They want what's in the best interest of their children. They want to protect their children. They want to empower their children. They want to educate their children. They want to share experiences with their children. They want to love their children. They want their children to love them in return. So the very presentation of the central thrust of the Torah, which is the covenant, frames who Yahweh is. Once you know that he is the father of the covenant family, you know, there's not a whole lot out there at that point to wonder about. I mean, I think that perspective is the single most important thing you can glean from the Torah, that the Torah is our Heavenly Father's advice to his children. I've done a whole lot of talking here without letting you all chime in, but
what else would be the point?
Other ideas?
No, you're there. Yes. All right. Let's look at it from Yahweh's perspective, and that's the way it should be written. You're right. You're right.
Now, that being the case, I will tell you that everything that I have tried to do with this program, with the Shattering Myths program, with the books, is to come to understand Yahweh's perspective, who he is, what he wants, what he's offering, what he would like to see from us, what he's chosen to do. That is the if you would use the term here, the imperative, that's the imperative. That's the goal, that's the quest, that is the search. Because the more you know about who he is, what he wants, what he's offering, the better position you are to understand everything in the universe, everything that's happening, why it's happening, why people are opposed to him, why people are fond of him, why he is so deserving of our respect and reverence and appreciation, how you go about just getting comfortable with him is to do that. And the moment you your perspective on everything, including translation, is his perspective as Father of the Covenant, there's nothing that's difficult anymore. You can still make mistakes. I mean, there is no child ever that has been perfect, that has learned everything their parents have tried to share perfectly. You know, so we still make mistakes, but we're going to be right the preponderance of the time when we come to know who he is and what he's offering. So, long story short, let's get into the translation. You want to see. You have chosen to notice. This is the call imperative. The call, of course, is literal interpretation, genuine. No hypotheticals here. No, we're not talking about symbolic meaning here. We're just talking. I mean,
you're
what
in
I say,
154, is that right?
I'm in 153.
153.
Yeah, 153. I'm going to move on to 154 in a moment. Got the same issues with 154 that we have with 153.
So, yeah, sure. You're going to have the issue.
First word is ra'ah. It means to see. And it was written in the call imperative. So call, no nuanced meaning here. This is the words are clear. I mean what I said. I said what I mean. Call imperative, which is a second-person expression of volition. So it expresses the person being spoken to. All right? Person being spoken to, here's a capital U. It's Yahweh. And that's the only you here. David would never speak of himself as you, right? David does not present himself as second or third person. Doe doesn't.
Right. So the only first person.
So the only second person in this discussion is Yahweh.
I think only you. Bob Dole does that.
Yes, well, that's true. You want to see. You want to see my response and diligence. You want to see my willingness to answer the call and actively engage. All right, so this is expressing what God wants. God wants us to observe his Torah guidance, to listen to his advice, and based upon what he has provided in terms of information, to respond, to answer the call. You know, he provided invitations. He wants us to answer the call and actively engage. Now, in this particular case, O-N-Y is a, wow, that's a challenging word to translate. One of the things we find when you look it up is that it is a derivative of Anna. And Anna may be the, I would say that Anna is easily within the top 10 most important verbs to understand in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Anna is the operative verb in many of the Moed Mikre, where Yahweh is encouraging us to respond to his invitation and to answer him. He's given us an invitation. He's provided guidance. He wants us to respond to his guidance and answer the invitation. Ana conveys that. This is a derivative of Ana. And it is throughout the Moed Mikre that he uses this term to tell us that on the days that he has invited us to meet with him, that he'd like us to respond, to answer the invitation, and to then he goes on to say, and come into the presence of the maternal aspect of his light. So it's conveying our effort. You know, Ana is our response. In this case, Dave was writing himself, so my response to the invitation, my witness and my song. Ana also speaks of witness and of providing a song. So you want to see my song. You want to see my response. You want to see my diligence. You want to see my willingness to answer the invitation and the call and actively engage. That's what God wants. And if you were to prioritize what Yahweh wants, I think this is first and foremost. That's why, by the way, Rosh, the Hebrew word for that is depicted with the head, which this is the first verse under that segment. Do you know what Rosh also means in addition to head? I'll give you a hint. It is Rosh is the essential aspect of the first word in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Barashit in the beginning.
Beginning.
Rosh means first.
I had my mic muted by accident there.
Oh, okay. So you knew the answer.
I was
all
talking
right.
And I'm like, how come?
Okay.
I realized I muted my mic.
No, I understand. We all speak English, Rosh, Resh is not one of the words that we see all that often, but I'm glad you knew. All right. So this segment is brought to us by the letter that is depicted by a human head, which is the source of observation, the source of listening, the source of responding, because it's our mouth, which we observe with our eyes, we listen with our ears, and we respond with our mouth, but not before we process what we have observed and heard through our brains. And it's a word that means first and foremost. So first and foremost, beyond anything else, because this is, I know that first and foremost is not in the sentence, but the letter that is bringing us the sentence means first and foremost. So under first and foremost, you have, you want to see my response and diligence, my willingness to answer the call and invitation and actively engage. So after 152 statements, systematically arranged by letter, closely examining and carefully considering the four most important aspects of Yahweh's Torah, we now have Dode saying, more than anything else, first and foremost, this is what God wants. I think that's brilliant. And if you were to ask 1,000 people, what does God want? I would suggest to you that only his covenant children could answer the question accurately. What he wants is for us to respond to him. He wants us to show some diligence in coming to know him. He wants us to be willing to answer his invitations for us to meet with him. He wants us to engage in his covenant. That's what God wants, first and foremost. You guys have anything else you think that God wants more than that?
Well, the way I would have put it, was that he wants to know us in a relational sense, and the only way that he's going to know us in a relational sense is for us to respond appropriately.
Correct.
To his invitations, and
correct,
to know what those invitations are. I mean, you know, how do you respond to the choke as an example if you don't even know what the choke is?
Right.
You know,
how do you respond to
the
mitzvah? Yeah, if you don't know what they are. How do you respond if you don't know what you're responding to?
Exactly.
Which is why Oni conveys both response and diligence. And it also conveys, in addition to answering the invitation, the call, actively engaging. That's why he used Oni here and not Anah. It conveys everything that Anah conveys, but also this concept of engaging and diligence.
So we're going to say here, you want to see my response and diligence, my willingness to answer the call.
Absolutely. Yes.
And actively engage.
Right. And under that basis.
I've been going through the whole thing right now doing it, so I think I've got it done, but we'll see.
Yeah. And if this is a in-process thing, because, you know, I just caught the mistake. Cause I like to read through what we're going to cover before and think about it, and I was doing it, and I every time I've done it for these passages, I've been so uncomfortable with the expression of volition. I don't have a problem with it being volitional, but it was the wrong person expressing the volition. I really don't care what Dode wants. I really don't. I care what Yahweh wants. I care what Dode knows. I care what Dode can teach me. I happen to like Dode. I find him totally and completely fascinating. But Dode can't save me. Dode can't invite me into the family. Dode's not making any of these promises relative to the covenant. But I really want to know what Yahweh wants. And having this come to us under first and foremost, under the thoughtfulness of the head, after observation and listening and contemplation, that first and foremost, you want to see my response and my diligence. You want to see my willingness to answer
really
the call and invitation and actively engage.
This is a very strong passage here. I mean, this it's an incredibly powerful, powerful passage. I mean, it's taking us right to where we're trying to be, which, you know, there's so many people, there's so many religious types, let me say this, that are looking for wealth. I mean, it's just give me a second here. It's like saying, you know, you say you're rich and I say you're poor and naked. You know, he's not talking about the world from our perspective here and now. He's talking about from his perspective, because the wealthy people are stakeholders in the covenant. That means they're part owners in the universe. That
Correct.
Means they are extremely wealthy. And
Correct.
So everything Yahweh is directing us to has to deal with becoming a being of light,
yep.
leaving the earth, as this passage points out. I just wanted to throw that in there. That's a
yeah.
very strong statement.
I'm going to tell you that when you properly express second person volition, which is what the imperative exists to express second person volition, when you render it as such and express it as Yahweh's desire, I mean, all of a sudden, this becomes the crescendo of this entire psalm. It becomes the lesson. You know, Dode has done all this study, and now this is the conclusion. First and foremost, you want to see my response and diligence, my willingness to answer the call and invitation and actively engage. That's what Dode learned. That's Dode's declaration of what he has ascertained from reading the Torah that Yahweh wants. It is, by the way, when I read the Torah, the thing that makes me the happiest, the most content, and the angriest is this realization. Now, why do I say that? When I read the Torah and I come to know how clearly Yahweh went about through prophecy and through his explanation of creation and the flood to prove conclusively that he is God and introduced so that we would know for certain that what we were reading came from the architect of the universe, the designer of DNA. And then how this marvelous individual very clearly laid out his heart's desire, which was for us to choose to be his children. And then he painstakingly provided the explicit means that we could engage in by way of celebratory parties, meeting with him to provide the means for us to be part of his family, to be eternal, to be perfected, to be adopted, to be enriched, to be empowered. When I realized how marvelous that is, how clear that is, how profound that is, I am reassured. I am comforted. However, I become very angry. It really makes me mad. Really pisses me off, to tell you the truth. I'm not mad at God, obviously. I'm mad at all of the religious morons throughout time who have chosen to corrupt and to conceal that marvelous offer and generous opportunity. And what this
well,
says is that well, don't
exactly
remember the same
we
conclusion.
Have religions. You know, I mean, they framed them. You know, it takes a
yeah.
lot to frame a religious deity. You have to rewrite
right.
everything.
You do. And if you are to, when you properly observe the Torah with an open mind, this is what you see. What you see is a Heavenly Father inviting us into his family and him wanting to see us express some diligence, some seriousness in our study, so that we come to know him and what he's offering, which then enables us to respond, and our willingness to answer his call to be called out of the world and his invitations so that we can engage in the covenant. That's what he wants. You know, when you realize how much more beneficial this is for us than for him, it ought to be what every human being on earth wants. And yet this is an expression of what God wants. In other words, he wants what's best for us.
This is why you feel like somebody pounding your head against the wall all the time, isn't it? I mean, really?
Yeah.
Saying, look, here's the offer.
Right.
You know, we're he's
look how beautiful
right
this offer is. Right.
Yeah, it's a great deal for you. There's no better deal on the planet.
Correct.
There's no better deal in the universe. You put it in front of 100 people. Two of them take you up on it. You spend 3 weeks feeding them information, and they go right back to the concept of a religious deity and grace. And you go, and, you know, I got to tell you, I just had one of those weeks. I had a worthless week, a worthless week. I was like beating my head against a wall. I spent hours feeding people that shouldn't have been fed at all.
Yeah.
It was insane.
And there is an aspect of this, Larry, that that encompasses the thing that I think is the most important to you. It's certainly among the things that's most important to me, so you're not alone in this regard. That a God who would want us to respond to him, a God who wants us to answer his invitations and actively engage in his family, isn't issuing orders. He's not establishing laws. He is not commanding us to do something. He's not a lord. He's approachable. He's relaxed. He's comfortable. If anything, he's actually humble. A God that could accomplish anything that he wants, that's saying, you know what I really want is I want you to answer my invitations to party with me. I want you to be part of my family. That's the antithesis of a religious deity, of the antithesis of a lord.
I see we've got a fellow H. Torres that I've never seen in the chat room. I want to give you a call
it's
out
a
there.
A friend
how you
of
doing?
Williams.
Oh,
okay.
Is it? Well, doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, any friend of Williams is a friend of ours. That's just all there is to it. We, boy, we are part of Williams' fan club. I'm sure William doesn't think he has a fan club, but nonetheless, we love William. All right, so let's go on. So this is chalats is the next verb. It speaks of equipping and empowering. You know, once we engage in the covenant. What does a father do when you respond to his invitation? When you show a willingness to answer the father and respond and engage, what does a father wants to do? He wants to empower. He wants to prepare. He wants to equip. So chalat speaks of those things. It was written in the Peel imperative. Now, the Peel imperative is ever so slightly different than the call imperative. What the Peel says is that the object is being influenced. The object is being acted upon. So if Yahweh, you, is the subject, Dode is the object. And Dode here represents a child in the covenant. He's... every time that Dode uses me, every time Dode speaks, presents himself as the object of something, you're fully entitled, empowered, authorized to put yourself in that position. Okay? He is speaking on behalf of all of the covenant's children. So, you have chosen to prepare me so that I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn. You want to equip and empower me so that I'm prepared to be drawn out of this world, removed from it, and delivered. And in time, so that I'm equipped for battle. That's chalats, isn't it? A great word. I mean, there are Hebrew words that have so many meanings. That the thing that I like about amplification, which is what this does here, is rather than you and I deciding that what Dode was inspired to write here was that, so you have chosen to prepare me, and then move on to the next. But if you do that, you're leaving so much of the possibilities of chalats unspoken. Now, while that may be all that Dod meant to convey, or Yahweh meant to convey through Dod, that you have chosen to prepare us. And since it means these other things, I'm a whole lot more comfortable personally in conveying everything that this word can mean that is appropriate in this context, considering the inspiration of the passage. And therefore, it can mean you have chosen to prepare me. You have chosen to save me. You have chosen to withdraw me. You have chosen to equip me. You have chosen to empower me. You have chosen to take me out of this world, removing me from it. You've chosen to deliver me. You've chosen, in the meantime, to equip me for battle. You tell me which one of those things you think would be inappropriate considering Yahweh's nature, Yahweh's teaching, Yahweh's purpose. Which of those possibilities would you feel comfortable removing from consideration? I don't think any of them. I think they all apply.
No.
And by the way, I like the idea of being prepared for battle. I like the idea of being equipped for battle.
I love that idea.
Yeah. You know, I do. I think that Yahweh does a marvelous job of preparing us to engage in the most important battle on earth. Now, in this battle, we're not using all weapons of war. We're not using any weapons of war. We're not wielding knives and guns and bombs. We're only using...
wielding words.
That's right. And not even our words. His words.
No, God's words.
His words, absolutely. The most powerful tool, the most powerful implement, most powerful entity in the universe is Yahweh's testimony. His words. That's how he equips us for battle. That's the implement that we use in the battle. It is our shield. It is our spear. It is our arrow. And while Yahweh's words don't always resonate within the ear, mind, and mind of the hearer, they're always effective. And what do I mean by that? You said that you tried to feed a lot of people this week, Larry, who just were not good listeners, who had all manner of objection, and it never sunk in. And by the way, just what we've gone over right here, there's enough right here to chew on, to the whole idea of the cud and the digesting it over and over and over again of that which we consume as food, which is good for us. You could chew on this and swallow it and consume it and be nourished by it and chew on it some more for days. I mean, the implications of what we've already considered are so profound. Now, there are times where you'll share that with somebody, and it just won't resonate because they're way too into their affinity for their religious God.
Well, it was particularly weird. I'll go ahead and finish. Engage me asking for the drink, and you give it to them.
Right. And they won't drink it.
Right.
But that does not mean that what you did was ineffective. What you did was effective. Absolutely effective, totally reliable, totally dependable, totally appropriate. The very fact that somebody won't capitalize on it doesn't diminish the effectiveness of the testimony. So what you did was effective. It's just that because of free will, those who you provided the effective response to chose not to be affected by it. But that doesn't diminish in any way the effectiveness of what you shared. And that's kind of the way I look at it now. You know, if somebody wants to reject what Yahweh was offering and what he said, so be it. You know, it's not only of no consequence to me. It's actually a benefit to me. Now, that might sound stupid, but I would say that if you share, like here, you shared Yahweh's testimony with people that had asked for it and then were unwilling to consider it. Why is that a benefit to you that they rejected it? I'm going to tell you. Okay, it might sound selfish, but this is my perspective. Do you want to spend eternity with somebody who's is not willing to benefit from Yahweh's invitation, Yahweh's instruction, Yahweh's guidance?
No, I don't.
No,
benefit. They cut themselves off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, eternity is a really long time. We're going to be spending a long time together. I want to spend all of that eternity selfishly, but I mean, I'm going to look at it from a selfish point of view. Yahweh should be looking at it as a selfish point of view. We don't want to spend our eternity with somebody who disregards Yahweh's testimony, because we're going to cling to everything he has to say, share, and reveal. And somebody who is a wet blanket, who is distracted, doesn't want to hear it, I don't want them around.
Well, imagine somebody just hounding you for more information, more information, more information. You give them ITG, you give them yada yada, and they, you know, they all want to read the end of the book first. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And
tell me what
so
I need to do. Don't confuse me with all this information. But
yeah, you're giving them bits and pieces, you know, in notes that are designed to put things together, you know,
right,
to make connections.
Right. Right.
And at the end of it all, and you know, my overriding theme, straight out of the box, is Yahweh is not a religious deity.
Right.
And
now,
then you
I would
get,
ask you this,
but
I'm
we still need grace. We still need grace. Oh, I went.
For what? Yeah.
I not
verse one,
at
this
all,
is verse 153. There are 176 in this psalm. I would propose to you that 153 is much closer to the end than it is to the beginning.
Yeah,
so,
you're right.
Okay, all right. So why is that important? We've just come to a statement that tells you really all you need to know about God. It really does.
Yeah, he's pleased that you've come to recognize how to respond
right,
to him.
And that you're engaging in his covenant actively. Now, was that presented in the first 10%, 20%, 30%?
No.
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 You can't get to the position that you can respond and engage until you've made the connections, until you've done the observation. You know, observation has to precede response. That's why this is way down at, even though this is the single most important statement that we have considered so far, it's 153 statements into this because it doesn't resonate until you've done your study and it makes sense to you. That's why when you are telling people, these are the things you need to understand, these are the connections you need to make before you're in a position to act and respond, so I can't give you the answer at the end of the book before you've considered what is presented before that. I mean, it's all about coming to know who God is, what he's offering, and then, based upon that, responding.
Yeah, it's going to sound like astrophysics when you're still in elementary school adding 2 plus 2.
Right.
Yeah, I know
right,
that.
You need to understand, what is the connection between the Moed Mikre and the covenant? You have to understand that. You know,
yeah, on both sides of the issue, by the way. On both
right,
sides of the issue.
Right. If you fail to understand the connection between the covenant and the Moed Mikre, then the Moed Mikre aren't of any value to you. Because the Moed Mikre are only for Yahweh's children, and it's Yahweh's means of honoring and delivering on his promises regarding the benefits of the covenant.
Yeah, they could just become religious holy days, as an example.
Right. So it is essential
you wouldn't
understand to
understand anything,
the relationship between the covenant, which came first. You know, unless I'm mistaken here, before Yahweh introduces his Moed Mikre, he begins by delineating the terms and conditions and the benefits of his covenant. Doesn't he start there with the covenant and then go to the Moed Mikre?
That's right.
Unless you are engaged in the covenant, unless you understand how the Moed Mikre serve the covenant's children, then you're wasting your time with them. And so that's why this comes towards the end of this, not at the beginning of it. It's a process. It requires diligence. So, this next statement.
The relationship.
So you, yes. Yeah. Yeah, hi, William. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good, Yada. How you doing? How you doing?
That's King Elevator, isn't it?
Yeah.
King Elevator.
Yeah, I am. I'm a happy camper because here, you know, I had profound insights, profound affirmations, amazingly reassuring testimony that I'm seeing for the first time. And so
that was a pretty giant revelation, wasn't it? I mean,
oh,
really.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's...
what do you mean for you?
Yeah, well, since I figured it out today that, you know, I began the show by saying I made a mistake. I rendered the volition inaccurately. And
A decade later. Yeah, I'm hearing
and,
that. But,
yeah, and ever since I realized that today, I've had goosebumps. Yeah, it's that I am literally that excited about learning something profound or having something profound reaffirmed from Yahweh. Yeah,
it's extremely profound. It's as profound a statement as you're going to find anywhere in Yahweh's words. Right.
And the only thing better than coming to see how important, seeing how reassuring this statement is being able to see it and understand it the moment before you have an opportunity to share it in a program like this. So how am I, William? I'm in heaven. That's how I am. How are you?
I'm feeling the same way. I feel like that every day.
Yeah.
Every time, you go through the mill, if you will, with work and all of that, and you're out there in the world engaging, you know, you realize that, I guess for the most part, you're kind of playing in Satan's background, sadly, but, you know, it doesn't affect me because I know that, I know where I'm going after this, and I just, that's where my eyes are set, so, you know, I'm focused, and I don't allow myself to be consumed by the, all of the derogatory things taking place around me. So,
and that's to a large degree because Yahweh wanted to see your response, your diligence, your willingness to answer the call and actively engage, and therefore Yahweh has chosen to prepare you so that you're ready to be saved and withdrawn, so you're equipped and empowered, so that you are prepared and equipped for battle. Peel imperative. And again, what the peel does here is it says that we are being influenced by the subject. Or excuse me, by the object. Oh, no, by the subject. Excuse me. Subject is Yahweh. We're being influenced as the object by the subject. So the subject here is you, Yahweh, because of the second person volition of the imperative. But the peel says that we as the object of this are being influenced. It's like we could say William drove the elevator. So the elevator was influenced by William's operation of it. In this particular case, the verb is to prepare, so we're ready to be saved, to withdraw, to equip. And so this is, and in this case, it's not William, but God himself is preparing, equipping, and saving and withdrawing, you and me, we are the beneficiaries of that action. That's what the peel conveys. And the imperative, of course, as we just have been considering, expresses not Dode's choice. And before I had it, you know, I wanted to be prepared. I was ready to be saved. This is what I want. Well, of course that's what Dode wants. That's what everybody wants.
Right.
What we want to know is, what does God want? And this, and in the imperative, it expresses not only what Yahweh wants, but it expresses its influence in the peel on us. So you have chosen to prepare us so that we're ready to be saved and withdrawn. Now, I know that I've changed the me to us and the I to we, but that's the intent of this. That's the way this was designed to be recited in red.
And now, it's interesting, because outside of joy and all of these other emotions that you'll feel knowing that, you also, I mean, and I think I could say that it's safe to say this for the entire family, that you have a feeling, you're fearless. There's
yeah.
no more fear, ever. Like,
right.
I mean, I literally fear nothing. I really
yeah.
don't. I don't fear anything. Yeah. It's empowering.
Yeah, and that's something that I think we all share, is that we know, and
right.
it's who we know and what we know from him that causes all of us to have zero fear. I mean, I have absolutely no fear, and I
yep.
think that it's common amongst all of Yahweh's children, is a total and complete lack of fear. It's one of the reasons why, Larry, the things that really trips your trigger is when people want others to fear God, or a bogus translation says to, you know, fear the Lord. And this, what the realization here is that when you know, and this is what William has said, and I personally think this is a perfect summation of what we're to glean from this statement. If Yahweh wants and has chosen to prepare us, to make us ready to be saved, to ready to be withdrawn, to equip and empower us and to do these things, then there, knowing who he is and how reliable and capable he is, we no longer have any fear of anything. Now, knowing that he wants us to respond and to engage in the covenant would mean that you can't know that and have any fear of him. But knowing that he's the one that is equipping us, we can't have any fear of anyone else. If he's equipping us for battle, who in the hell is going to? Are we going to be afraid of?
Who's well, no, I mean, that's true. And I've always looked at William. I mean, if not bold, he's at least a little cheeky or brassy.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, bold, blunt, courageous, fearless. All traits that Yahweh loves.
Intrepid, maybe?
Yeah, intrepid.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Intrepid,
yeah,
courageous.
You look at Dode. Now, if Dode is the guy that Yahweh loved more than anybody else, one thing you would say about Dode is, man, that dude was bold. I mean, bold.
Oh, yeah.
So in the end, when you finally realize all of that, right?
Right.
And again, I think it's safe to say this for the entire family. Doesn't that all translate into peace? You find peace.
Right.
It really
yeah,
does.
In the,
at least
in the full meaning of shalom, William,
mm-hmm.
you know, peace is not the absence of war.
Mm-hmm.
But peace in the full contemplation of the Hebrew word shalom, the relationship is reconciled. Everything has been resolved. You're completely relaxed because there is no longer any conflict.
Right.
That kind of peace. The full shalom concept of peace. You're in an enduring friendship without any friction. That's shalom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where you find yourself. So you have chosen to prepare me so that I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn, so that I'm equipped for battle, so that I am empowered and prepared to be drawn out of this world, because indeed I have not ignored nor overlooked, and I have not lost sight of nor responded inappropriately to. What do you suppose the noun is that follows? What did Dod do that caused Yahweh to want to prepare to save him and withdraw him from this world? What do you think that he didn't ignore? What did he never overlook?
The Torah.
That's it. Your Torah. Your source of teaching and instruction, and the place from which your direction and guidance flow. You know, 119, 153 as a complete thought is about as good as it gets, folks. You want to be in a position where Yahweh want to see you, want to know you, want to focus on you. Respond to His Torah. Answer His invitations. Engage in the covenant. Never, never, ever overlook, never ignore, and always respond appropriately to the Torah. Did Dod come to this position because he had faith in the gospel of grace?
No.
When Yahweh returns and establishes his kingdom on earth in a celebration of Sukkah and the Shabbat for 1,000 years between year 6,000 Yah and 7,000 Yah, is there any mention of him establishing the kingdom of St. Paul?
No.
There's a mention of him establishing a kingdom of love, of Dod.
Of Dod.
There sure
yeah,
is.
Of
yeah,
of Dod. Based upon this dude, right? This guy.
Wow.
Right? So you might say that if Yahweh, creator God of the universe, is going to come back to earth for the express purpose of establishing his kingdom and camping out with us for 1,000 years, and he says that he's going to establish this consistent with his buddy Dod, might we assume that the likelihood of Dod being inspired by Yahweh and us being able to read what Dod wrote with great confidence that it is consistent with Yahweh's perspective? Wouldn't you think that's a reasonable chance that that's the case?
I'd say that's a fair assumption to make. I think you'd be all right there. Yeah.
I think you'd be all right. I think when you read anything that Yahweh said through Moshe in the Torah, anything that Yahweh said through Yahusha in the first book concluding the Torah, if you were to read anything that Yahweh proved that he inspired through his prophets, and you read anything that was inspired through Dod, I think you've got a 100% chance all of the time, every word being reliable, being informative. And folks, they don't get any better than these. You want to see me. Respond. You want to see my response. You want to see my diligence. You want to see my willingness to answer the call and invitation and actively engage. And you have chosen to prepare me so that I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn, to equip me for battle, because indeed, I have not ignored nor overlooked. I have never lost sight of nor ever responded inappropriately to your Torah. By the way, that verb, that shaka, actually, it was negated by lo, so it's shaka is to be mindful, to never forget, to always remember, to care about. It was negated, so he says, I have never failed to do these things regarding your Torah. It was written in the call perfect. Call means literally, and the perfect is completely and totally. So, you know, Dod had his issues, but one of his issues was not failing to observe the Torah. Now, there's lots of things that he did that were in conflict with the Torah, but they were behaviors.
You mean he wasn't like a holy guy, all pure and running around sort of sexless and that type of thing. He was an actual real human being,
right,
that made all kinds of mistakes.
Yeah, in fact, I would put it this way. Does Dode prove that the Torah is for perfect people, as Paul and Christians would say? Yeah, the Torah is great if you're perfect. Does Dode prove that the Torah is for perfect people, or does the Torah prove, via Dode, that it's designed to make flawed people perfect?
The latter of the two.
Yeah. Yeah. Dode, I mean, Yahweh says that Dode's perfect. He's righteous. He's tzedak. So, and he clearly is flawed by his own admission. So the Torah, therefore, is to make flawed people perfect. You know, and I'm really glad, because I happen to be a flawed person from my own behavior, but not from Yahweh's perspective.
But what if I'm 10 times more flawed than you are? Am I still in the game?
Yeah, you know, because, first of all, I would never want to engage in a who's more flawed contest, because I might lose and all accounts. But since you have put it the other way, the opposite way that I would have stated it, the amount of flaws that you have, William, is highly unlikely to exceed the number of flaws that Dode had. And since Dode, with all of those flaws, was considered perfect in Yahweh's eye, righteous, tzedak, I think you and I are in pretty good shape. I don't know about Larry, but you and I are in pretty good shape.
I've fallen off the wagon pretty hard, but let me tell you, I come back.
Yeah, you know.
Larry,
you know, Dode did too. He fell off. He fell off the wagon hard.
He made me look like a piker, pal.
Did you know that, Yada?
Oh yeah.
What's that?
Did you know that about Larry? Most people don't know he was the leader of the Latin Kings.
I tried to keep my ethnicity a secret over here. But see, that's how I knew William was King Elevator. You know, when he was a member, that's what we called him.
Okay. All right. Well, now that we know this. Okay. Moving to the next statement. It says, you want to present an argument to defend me. And this, by the way, 154 is where I just had this horrible sinking feeling as I was preparing for today's program. When I wrote it, I want you to present an argument to defend me. What Dode wants is irrelevant. I mean, the only thing that's relevant about what Dode wants is for Dode to decide that he wants to participate in and engage in the covenant. But that's not between Dode and you and me. That's between Dode and Yahweh. So, I'm telling you, when I wrote it as, because it had the imperative, and I knew the imperative conveyed volition, and it had a first-person pronoun associated with it, I said, well, must be, I want you to present an argument to defend me. Why would Dode say, and I was going to say, why would Dode say that? We've just gone through 153 statements that shows a profound understanding of the Torah, which is Yahweh's profound, complete, perfect plan and argument to defend us. He's already there. He can't want one because he already has one. It's in the Torah. Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavuah. Yahweh has already presented his defense for us. Already there. And so when I wrote it as first-person volition, it was never comfortable for me. I said, okay, yeah, well, of course Dode wants that. We all want that, but in real we already have it. You know, why would you ask for God for something he's already given us? You know, for somebody who says, oh, God, I want you to save me. Well, he already has a plan to save you. Answer the invitation.
Engage in the plan.
Engage in the plan. And so
you chose not to avail yourself of it.
So many people. Yeah, if you think about Satan's corruptions, they're pretty brilliant. I mean, they really are. They really are.
Right.
They've got people respecting God, a God they don't know, a God that they fear, and a God that they pretend to love, all at the same time. Okay?
Right.
And they're respecting him. They're bowing their heads. I've had people tell me, that woman knew how to ask for forgiveness, how to get on her face. You know, I mean, I've heard people say these things.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you know something? Since I've come to know Yahweh, since I've become a child of the covenant, since I've begun answering his invitations to meet, you know what I've never asked for since that time?
Forgiveness or, yeah,
never asked
what's
for
the point?
Because Yahweh wouldn't even know what to forgive me for.
Yeah, there'd be a long list in there, wouldn't there?
Well, no. He doesn't even
know. Well, I guess
know.
There'd be none. He doesn't even know. Yeah,
that
he's
is correct.
Wiped out.
That is correct. He wouldn't even know what to forgive me for. So
yeah, you'd be up there asking a stupid question.
Why would I ask him to do what he has already done? I mean, I don't need to ask for his forgiveness.
It makes no sense.
I
don't need to ask him what his will is. I don't need to ask him for his forgiveness. I am appreciative of his forgiveness, and I happen to be very extraordinarily fond of his will, because his will is in your and my best interest. You know, the fact that he wants what is best for us is really cool to me.
You think about the genius of the cover-ups, of the smoke screen, of the plastering over, the whitewashing.
Right.
You know, that where somebody, they're kneeling and they're always prepared to go into a religious veneration for somebody. I've actually heard these things. I had a woman, I heard her say, oh, she was just the best person. She was ready to pray at the drop of the hat for you.
You're wasting your time.
Insane.
This now becomes awesomely profound. You, Yahweh, want to present the argument to defend me. You want to argue the legal case on my behalf based on my choices. Now, in this particular case, we have two expressions of volition. Not one, but two. It's rib-ah, which means you have chosen to resolve any legal dispute against me by pleading my case. It was written in the call imperative paragogic. All right, call, literally, reliably, genuinely. Imperative, second person expression of volition. You want, this is Yahweh's will, Yahweh's desire. This is what God wants to do. But paragogic is a first person expression of volition, I and me. So in this statement, you need to incorporate, if you want to, you know, understand the moods, the perspective here, you have to convey both second-person volition, what God wants, and first-person volition from the paragogic, what Dode wants. All right? I mean, this is powerful. How many times you get I don't know of many places where you have a double expression of volition in the same statement. And this, by the way, is the passage that I came to this afternoon as I was preparing for our program and said, I got this wrong. I really need to open my books up again, and I need to understand. James, that when you're doing your translations, I hope that you've reached this point. I know I have, where even before I'm dealing with the word, I know what to expect. And in this particular case, I knew I had the person of volition wrong, and I knew that if I opened my tools and studied if this that I would find that it wasn't Dode's expression of volition initially, but Yahweh's, and then Dode secondarily, that this would all make sense. I knew that's what I was going to find. And I opened Logos, and I went through each of these passages, and I found exactly what I expected to find. And I just had this overwhelming sense that do the due diligence. This is what you're going to find. But I had no, and I knew it's going to fix the translations. I don't think I suspected it would be this profound. Yahweh, as our Father, provided the ransom, provided the means for us to be free, for us to be perfect, for us to be adopted, for us to be enriched and empowered. He provided the means in a legal way, a way that was, this is my testimony under oath, in that kind of, you know, in a trial where he is the judge, he's providing his testimony under oath that he says, if you will follow this guidance, if you will walk down this path, which I myself have provided, then this is what you can expect. Total liberation, total freedom, enrichment and empowerment, adoption, perfection, and eternal life. And since Yahweh has delineated that on our behalf in his Torah, and then honored those promises through Yahusha, what he wants to do is to argue the case that he has brought on our behalf. You know, someone asked the other day, I think it was you, William, in our last program, you know, why did Yahweh do it this way? You know, why did he delineate the Pesach and Matzah, and why did he have to serve in this way? Why was that the plan? I mean, that sounds like Yahweh enduring an enormous amount of pain and anguish on our behalf. Wasn't there some other way that he could exonerate us?
Right.
And this is the answer to that. Since Yahweh designed this plan, which was totally just, since he paid the penalty, since he accepted the consequence, since Yahweh now stamped our record as exonerated because you've been ransomed, because someone else has accepted your penalty, now he is prepared to do what he wants, which is to exonerate us, to defend us.
Right.
So this says, you want to present the argument to defend me, arguing the legal case on my behalf based upon my choices. And I genuinely seek your in fact, I've got it here. I generally seek your redemption. That needs to be changed. It's because it is also written in the imperative. So it's expressing, and you genuinely want to redeem me. That's how it has to be written. And you genuinely seek to redeem me. That's what it means. So you have to, I told you, doing this on the fly, I didn't catch all of them. Call imperative. So you want to present the argument to defend me, arguing the legal case on my behalf based upon my choices, because this has two expressions of volitions, first person and second person, and you genuinely seek to redeem me. You want to save me. You want to free me. You decided of your own free will to pay the ransom. Call imperative. Because, now this is Peel imperative, second person volition, because you have chosen to restore me so that I might live. Your desire is to revive and transform me, to nurture me so that I might grow, endure, and persevere forever. Peel tells us that Yahweh is influencing, is acting upon us in this way because this is what he wants. But, and this is a huge but, he is not doing this for everybody. He is not there to save all of the little children. It doesn't say here he loves everyone, that he has chosen to restore everyone. No. According to your word, your instruction, and your promise, your Imra, your message. So, Dode is recognizing that Yahweh has chosen to present our defense. So he's the perfect judge. We're all flawed. He is ready to and wants to present our defense, to exonerate us. And that he really, genuinely seeks to redeem us, which is the specific means that he's using to exonerate us, is to redeem, is to buy back, is to pay the price to reacquire us. Because you have chosen to restore us so that I might live. And this is, it's important to know that that Chawa is not only the Hebrew word for live, but other than the hard CH sound versus the softer He sound, it's identical to the word that defines Yahweh's name, Haya, to exist.
Existence. Yeah.
According to your word, your instruction, and your promise. And that's the part that so many people miss, even if they get the first part right, which I don't think you could get any understanding of this from any English translation. But even if you were to get the first part right and understand that, yeah, Yahweh does want to redeem us. Yeah, Yahweh wants to restore us. Yes, Yahweh wants us to live. Yes, all that's true in accord with his instruction and his promise, his Imra. And where would you find that which is in accord with his promise?
That'd be in the Torah.
That would be in the Torah. In fact, Dode's already pointed us in that direction, didn't he? Last statement, that it was in the Torah. Remember, everything in Hebrew, this is poetry, these are the lyrics of a song, everything in Hebrew poetry is designed to be a couplet, to say the same thing using different words. In this case, Torah was replaced by Imra. So, Yahweh's word, his instruction, and his promise is equivalent to the Torah.
I got a question, Yahweh.
Go ahead.
This is H. Torah 718. My name's Herman.
Okay, hi, Herman. How are you?
Hey, how are you? How is everyone?
Good. You're the friend of William, correct?
Sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm very good friends with his aunt, Amy.
Okay, yeah, she's a sweetheart. She's been on this program several times. And, she's the one that told us that it really isn't William, it's Willie.
Willie, in fact.
Willie.
Right. Yeah, very good friend, very dear friend of me. And,
she's a sweet lady.
She allowed me to see, she's beautiful.
By the way, and I think it's her son, isn't it, that's the young man that has come to know Yahweh and is so resolute in his acceptance of Yahweh that he stands firm in the face of pushback from teachers and school alike.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. He's standing strong.
Yeah.
Correct. My question, what I always question myself is in understanding how Yah loves and how he wants you to have a relationship, how he wants a relationship with you.
Right.
And then I hear you banter with Larry and William about Latin Kings and things you've done in the past, and I didn't know Larry was a member, so I'll go ahead and I'll say hello to him.
I don't even know what Latin Kings is.
That's a joke.
And I think he's being facetious, because I don't even think there is such an organization as Latin Kings.
No, there really is. It's a gang.
It's a gang.
Everybody's king or somebody.
All right. I'm sorry for being so out of touch, but I didn't know that it was a gang. But
get it together,
it was a gang.
Hip up a little bit.
Yeah. I know.
Larry has never
been a member of a gang. Nor has William.
If you see Larry Yahweh wearing a lot of black and gold, keep an eye on him.
Herman, and for everyone here, We like to approach everything associated with Yahweh with humor. God loves to have a good time. Yeah, he likes to party.
I'm enjoying myself.
He's fun. We relax around him. We poke fun. We use sarcasm, and it's because we are so liberated to enjoy our relationship with one another and with him that and he has a sense of humor. So the boys were kidding.
Well, of course they were. And speaking of liberation is what I'm called. How does one liberate themselves with the guilt that they have? You see, I practiced the Christianity thing, the whole baptism thing, and had no problem denouncing it or walking away from it. None at all whatsoever.
Right.
It just never seemed right anyway.
Right. And it isn't.
I forgive myself for things that I've done have never been or has never come quite easy. Not even with the whole getting baptized and, oh,
yeah,
your sins are forgiven. Yeah, okay. Those are great words to hear, but I deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think all of us, I'm not going to speak for everybody here. I'm going to speak for me. I still have regret over some things that I have done. Does that mean that I have not forgiven myself? Yeah, probably. Yeah, I have regret. I have regrets of things that I have done. I mean, there's many things I've done in my life that I'm actually proud of, that I'm that I think, you know, it was a pretty righteous thing to do. You know, I've had a full life, lots of good, lots of bad, and the things that I have done that were inappropriate, I feel remorse for. But you know, so long as you and I, Herman, are not burdened by, that we're not held back by our mistakes, then they have no bearing, because Yahweh doesn't know them anymore. He doesn't care about them anymore. Yahweh paid a very dear price to ransom you from what you've done in the past. And he has a marvelous mechanism called the Set-Apart Spirit, that she is his maternal light. And she envelops us. She's got this garment of light. It is what we are adorned in, so that light completely removes darkness. Where there is light, there is no darkness. So we appear as light, as perfect light to Yahweh. So he is completely oblivious to whatever you have done or whatever I have done in the past that we are remorseful of. So our remorse doesn't change the equation whatsoever. And our remorse is only valuable. Our remorse is never valuable. Our remorse is only a hindrance if we allow it to be. Let me give you an example, Herman. So I'm going to speak for myself here, because the question, I hope I'm answering your question, is
please.
I made some mistakes in judgment in business. And I've become, unfortunately, very well known in business for having trusted people I should not have trusted. And if I were to allow my mistake in judgment to preclude me from doing this show because somebody could call up and say, well, you're the guy that was on the cover of Business Week that was made to look like a greedy lying fool. Now,
right.
I wasn't a liar. I wasn't greedy, and I wasn't a fool. But I still made mistakes in judgment. And so if I were to allow my mistakes, or, for example, I was an ordained ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church. I taught evangelism. I taught Bible studies. I was a deceiver. I was up to this with my eyeballs in this.
Really?
If I were to allow the realization that I was part of the problem to preclude me from sharing what I'm learning in Yahweh's testimony with others, then it would be a liability. Then it would be a handicap. I'll give you another one. I'm not qualified to provide these translations. I'm just flatly not. I mean, I haven't been schooled in any of this. I'm not qualified. If I were to allow my concern over my lack of qualifications to preclude doing this. I dare say that the vast majority of the people that are listening to this program tonight, including William's aunt and William and Larry and James, they wouldn't be part of the family. Not because I'm special in any way, shape, or form. It's the opposite of that. But the very right. fact that I was willing to share what Yahweh was teaching me through his testimony, knowing that I would be vulnerable, it created the opportunity for many people to come to know Yah and be part of his covenant. So I think that the answer to your question has been provided by what we've come up with so far, that when you come to know Yahweh and you know that you've been equipped by him, there is no fear. And having no fear and being in total freedom tells us that we have been released from our liabilities and that we've been equipped by the best. So go. Do it. Engage.
Right.
Be bold. Don't be held back by anything. So I'm speaking to you as a guy that's got a lot of regrets, a lot of faults, a lot of stupid things, and I'm not held back. You ought not be either.
Right. I try to keep in the forefront, Amy and I spoke one evening, on how my prayers in the past were on deaf ears. He didn't know me.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then as I walked towards him, and as he come towards me, through his Torah,
mm-hmm.
that's who he sees now.
Correct.
It's what I do now, because he didn't know of anything that I've done in the past.
Yeah, and by the way, he doesn't see everything that you do now.
I heard that from you and I was listening to an archive
right.
show.
Yeah, doesn't see everything you're doing now. The things that he sees you doing now are those things that bring him pleasure.
Wow.
Those things, when you, like, for example, when we come up with this profound understanding of what the imperative does, he's right here with us. He's seeing it. He's having a great time right here with us. And if an hour from now one of us does something that's, you know, less desirable, less beneficial, he's not going to see it.
Well, you know, my perspective on regret is
yep.
that it's necessary. It's good because it keeps you from committing that mistake again.
Yeah.
It's a reminder,
yeah.
right?
No, I agree.
And so,
I agree.
It's a teaching tool.
Yeah, so long
it's
as...
It's a teaching tool, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course. You know, we've talked about this, William, before, that, well, this is not true with James, who came to the covenant via being an agnostic. Larry, you and I were Christians. And
so,
had we not
yes.
been Christians, I don't think we would have had the empathy, the combination of this overall hatred of the religion so that we really want to free people from it because we understand the religion and how seductive it is, but also this desire on behalf of Christians and a specific understanding of how Yahweh's Torah is so different than Christianity. Had we not been a Christian, we would not be equipped to do these things. I think that's
right.
why Moshe was chosen to write the Torah and to liberate the chosen people. He knew the mindset of religion and politics. He knew the evil that existed in Egypt. Made him the perfect person to engage.
He was a part of it.
Right. And now he'd been taken from it, and he could contrast between the two, differentiate
right.
between the two. I think it's actually a benefit. Now, you know, in retrospect, I regret what I said and did.
Sure.
I know that I benefited from now knowing what I have been liberated from. Help liberate others from it.
Right.
No, William, we're in complete agreement that there, and I was going to go down that path, but I thought that since Herman's question was more of being able to forgive himself, that I would take the other road, but both tracks are equally important. I would agree with you, William.
Sure.
We We learn from our mistakes when we regret our mistakes, and that is the motivation not to repeat that mistake.
Right.
Yeah. That's our conscience working, by the way.
Herman and I attended the same non-denominational church, supposedly, in New York City. And that was the one I got kicked out of. Yeah.
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 Yeah. You don't want to ask them questions that they can't answer. No. You know, the 20 questions that that appear at the beginning of the new version of Questioning Paul. If you ask any variety of those questions, you won't stay there very long because they don't have any answers for those questions. They make them really uncomfortable. Unanswered questions are really tough on faith.
Well, there was a show you in. It was like 2 days ago, I believe. Yeah, you guys were basically it was pretty cool because I was with my boss's boss, the guy I told you about last week, and he and I were working together, and it was from 2 to 3. Okay, so you guys were actually recording exactly what he and I were talking about, and we weren't listening to the show or anything. So that night I went home and I was listening to the archives, and I mean one would have thought that I called you and asked you to talk about the show. I mean, it was that close that you spoke about.
That was the one where Larry and I were on for 2 hours, and Kirk called in the last like 45 minutes of that time.
No, this was wasn't yesterday. It was the day before yesterday. It was Wednesday.
Okay, all right.
And
because one
and
of those days, that was the day we had in the final hour, we had Larry and Kirk, and it was. In fact, I told Scott, the producer, at the end of the show, I said, that's about as much fun and as useful a discussion as I can recall having on this program. It was really – so I think we're speaking at the same day, and it was a day that I was prepared to speak entirely on Chabaouk. And we ended up talking all about it without actually citing it. It was a lot of fun.
Right. And so he you know, when I listened to that, it was probably about 9:30 at night, and I just texted him and I said, you know what, you need to listen to this. You know, you need to listen to this. And so, the next morning, I'm walking in to the office, and he's like, "You're really challenging me, man. You're really challenging me. This stuff's making sense." You know,
don't you love it when
like,
it
well, how do you explain
I love
this
an open-minded person.
He's a diehard Christian and he's like how do you explain that I was with you from 2 to 3 and these guys are talking about exactly what we're talking about? And I mean it was so strange because it was verbatim. Like that day you were talking about Halal Ben Shakar and I told him that was Hassan's name and it was interesting. So he was like, "I can't explain that. I can't explain that," you know. And I was like, I said, "Dude." And then there was another guy there, and he started to share with him.
Right.
So I was like, "This is real cool, man." Just the fact that these guys are thinking.
Yep.
I mean that.
Oh yeah.
You know, to me, that's like, all right. Well, you know, and I told him, I said, "Look, dude, the seed's been planted. Whether you blossom or not, that's up to you." You know, I have nothing to do with that. That's got to be your own decision. So,
and I want to share something that I think is important for Larry, still on the line here, for him to hear that when he calls in and we have a discussion. Now, you know, he knows that I lead the discussion in the sense that I'm asking him questions that he knows the answer to. I know the answer to, but. When we present the truth by way of a extemporaneous discussion like that, it's vastly more effective.
More entertaining, more effective.
It is
more everything.
It is.
I wish I could do more of it. I get stuck at work here.
Oh no, I'm not complaining. I'm just trying to reinforce that it, Larry, so that you know. That it is, and Kirk is the other one who is spectacular at engaging in very pertinent, stimulating discussion. It's more entertaining. It's more enlightening. It's more effective. So The more you guys do that, the more effective we will be in having Yahweh's testimony resonate with listeners.
There was a time you had a rabbi come on there who had written about five books or whatever, and that was entertaining to me because there were certain points in your discussion with him where you had to help him along and correct him, and I was like,
yes.
To me, I was blown away by that.
Yeah,
and you it was you guys departed amicably. There was no drama, no argument. You know, it was pretty cool.
And the fact is that since that was a friend of a friend, the entire concept there was I would, as you know, I'm not capable of listening to someone say something that's not true in a public forum like a radio program without correcting them. So I would, I was going to have to correct anything that he said that was not true, but I tried to do so in such a way that minimized any chance of hostility to make it simply a correction of perspective and definition. And so I, too, remembered that, and I was surprised as to how well that went, considering its potential for enormous hostility and animosity.
Right.
Yeah, because, as you know, I'm not fond of rabbis. I'm not fond of those who accept any religious title. And I'm not fond of anyone who proposes a religious idea. I view them as an enemy of Yahweh. And an enemy of Yahweh is no friend of mine.
Right. Well, why do you suppose that, you know, people who are religious, especially leaders, religious leaders, why do you suppose they don't call in to shatter a myth?
When I started this program, I thought that I was concerned that that was going to happen. I was concerned in the sense that it would turn out to be very hostile. And that I would have many religious clerics calling in to condemn and to challenge and the like. And initially, I was actually concerned that it will be difficult to have a civil conversation with someone that I disrespect that much. And I'm so opposed to someone using a forum to introduce Yahweh to encourage people to buy into the deception. And so I was really concerned that would be a dominant theme in the program. And I knew my own limitations, that I don't suffer fools well. And I'm very passionate. And when someone deceives on behalf of God, I get angry. And so I was really concerned that would happen, and it just hasn't. If you want me to guess as to why it hasn't happened, I would suspect that it is extremely difficult for someone to argue against what's being presented, because they're in fact having to argue against God himself. Now, I'm obviously not God, but we're citing his testimony and his perspective. And so, for example, if you were to call in while we're going through Chabaouk 1 and 2, you know, good luck with that.
Right.
I mean, how in the world are you going to argue against that?
They're talking with anyone who knows and understands more than they do, because more than anything, they hate to look like a fool. They love the,
you
respect,
know something
the honor
else there,
of the position, and you would make them look like a fool, and they know it.
And it's not because
the
I
other
might
problem,
know more
like
than
it.
They do. It's because the key word there is understanding. Once you understand, that is the ultimate equipment. You know, if you want to, the ultimate provision for battle is understanding. If you understand,
well, I want to set up a round table with you, Michael Savage.
Yeah.
I don't see this ending well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael Savage kicked me off his page. He kicked me off his page.
Once you understand and you know that that your understanding is based on the testimony and the work of the Creator of the universe, you know, you're in a position where it would be impossible for anyone to successfully argue against what you've been equipped to defend. So
well, no
I
one
would
can
assume
refute
that that's
God's
the reason.
Truth.
Yeah.
No one can refute it.
Right.
You can't. I don't care what degrees you have. I don't care what
I did a post on this very subject the other day, and you know what I said?
Right.
What I said is simple. You know, when you're not asking for money or you don't have a donate button, you're pretty hard to overcome.
You really are, yeah.
You know, I mean...
Right. The number one way that people go about
debating is that they
try to slander the messenger. So the most common way today to debate is to first slander the messenger. And if you're not accepting anything here, and you claim to be irrelevant, and you claim no qualifications, then slandering you doesn't do any good. And if you don't care that you're being slandered, it doesn't do any good. Then number two,
yeah, ad hominem. That's all they got.
Right.
That's
right.
It's all
ad
hominem.
Hominem argument is the most common. The second is to red herring, to say things that really aren't related, have no bearing on what's being talked about, for the purpose of changing the subject to a point they want to make, to something they think they can defend. So the red herring is next, and then there's the argument of the way to debate, which is you just throw out so many distractions that the person trying to undermine your
10 lies in a minute.
Right. You know, you can throw out a falsehood in a second, and it takes minutes to refute them. And so that's
the other part is, unlike most radio hosts out there, you're not interested in mass appeal. You're not trying to get as many listeners as you can. You're not afraid to alienate people with the truth.
Correct.
You know, the entire goal of Shattering This is to get the truth out there. And if that makes you turn off the radio, so be it. That's your call.
Yeah, it's your call.
Well, you're the only radio host who I've ever heard speak negatively about the ads that, you know,
typically that doesn't happen.
In the radio world, they're like, it's time to pay the bills, right?
And I'm actually conflicted about the most common ad, the people that's paying the bills. Yeah, the most common ad right now in the program, I'm a little conflicted on. It's the Alex Jones has decided that he wanted to replace Youngevity. Youngevity is one of the ads that I spent multiple shows destroying the credibility of the pyramid scheme of Youngevity. And so Alex Jones called the owner of GCN and his top lieutenant down to Austin, Texas, which is where he broadcasts for him, and got them to buy into his snake oil. Now, the difference, though, with Longevity and Youngevity and Alex Jones' snake oil is that Alex Jones, what he's saying about it is stupid, but it's he's not claiming to be a doctor. He's not claiming, which the Youngevity does with the vet. He's not claiming that it will cure you of cancer and cure you of every available type of disease, and he's not selling it as a pyramid scheme. He says, you know, I've got these herbs, I've got these minerals, I've got these extracts. They're the ones that have been used for a long period of time, and they're trusted. And then he makes a bunch of statements about them, where he'll say that, you know, this is the most powerful proprietary solution that I've ever offered. Okay, that's like me taking a cup of an empty cup, digging into my pool, and putting a grass clipping in it, and saying, "This is the most powerful remedy that I've ever offered to your health."
And it's proprietary.
Yes, because it's the only one I've ever offered. So, you know, I don't want to go to war against it, because the fact, if you really think about what he's saying, he's not saying anything that's inappropriate. And second, he got the fellas to agree to sponsor the ads and give, and Alex is donating half of the proceeds to better pay and better conditions at GCN for the guys like Scott that are paid minimum wage. And so I don't want to criticize it under those circumstances. So I listened to it. And I said, okay, maybe I'm a hypocrite here, but what he's really saying is true. It's just meaningless.
It's like when you hear radio shows advertise, our number one morning talk show. Well, it is the number one morning talk show on that station.
That's right. That's right. It's
you know,
their only
number
one.
Number one than anything else, but
it's their only
it's
one.
The number one morning show.
Hey, you guys want to hear a good one? I was one of the people I spent several days just feeding and answering question after question, sometimes like 4 hours a day, who finally got down to, we still need God's grace, and didn't get any of it, apparently. She offered me a love offering. Oh, I'll be happy to send you a love offering. She was blocked at that second. She wasn't getting any.
Oh, wow.
A love offering.
Oh, yeah.
I'm begging for dough over here.
Yeah.
Let
By the way,
jerk. I was insulted. That's insulting. It's rude.
We need Yahweh's mercy in the perfect tense once. Once.
Yes.
Once.
Yes. We don't need the pagan goddesses of grace.
No, no, and what we do need is mercy, but we need it once. Perfect tense.
Well, let's not confuse that with grace.
You engage in the covenant. You answer the invitations to meet with Yahweh. You're one of those who observes the terms and conditions of the covenant. You are the recipient of his mercy, chanan, and you need it once. One time will do. It's perfect. It's complete. It does everything you need. And you receive it, and thank you very much. So do you need Yahweh's mercy? No, you've already received it. I don't need it either. I've already received it. I've already benefited from it. So, and it's for certain that the English word grace is based upon the Latin gratia, and the Latin gratia is absolutely the Roman version of the Greek charities, the charis. And, you know, there is nothing they're offering that I'm interested in. I don't need it. I don't want it.
Yeah, isn't that exactly what... talk about putting your finger on Paulos again. You know,
oh, yeah,
the prophet
exactly.
Who continually uses pagan gods, you know, and attaches them to or associates them with me. He'll wish he was dead. Yeah, sure he will, because he's going to live forever.
Absolutely.
In the worst possible situation.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, guys, I promised my wife I was going to take her out to dinner tonight, and so I'm going to go do so. I had a ball tonight. There's very few things that are as exciting to me as learning something. I can't say new, because what we learned wasn't new. But something that helps reaffirm.
Better way to phrase it.
Yeah, that are a better way to phrase it and a way to reaffirm what we have come to conclude about the Torah and about Yahweh. When Dode expressed it this clearly using second person volition and to come to see that, very exciting stuff. So
that was a great show. Thanks. You guys had a good
fun. Yeah, lots of fun. Good night, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.